Do you tend to be more spontaneous or are you more structured? Are you flexible or are you pretty fixed in your approach? Do you live life without any controls and just kind of go with the flow? Or is life tightly controlled? Do you live without a budget and just spend? Or do you have a pretty fixed budget and it's got to fit into your categories? Do you tend to be more contemplative? Or are you more pragmatic? You know, what works? Do you tend to be more spirit-led? Or do you want things well thought out? Do you tend to be more prayerful? Or are you a planner? Now, with all of these contrasts, the reality is it's not an either or. It's a both and. Because we need both sides of the equation. In the passage we're going to look at this morning, we're going to see that prayer and planning really work together. Now, we need both. We need to pray, but we also need to prepare. We need to plan things out as well. We're in the midst of looking at the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, looking at principles of revival. And we saw that the first half of Ezra is about Zerubbabel bringing the first wave of exiles back to the promised land to rebuild the temple. The second half of Ezra is about Ezra coming back, bringing a second wave of exiles to rebuild the people, to encourage them. As the book of Nehemiah opens in chapter 1, as we saw last week, Nehemiah learns a bad report about the condition of the city of Jerusalem, that the walls have still not been repaired. They've been broken down for possibly 150 years. And so Nehemiah is going to spend 4 months in prayer, in fasting, and in planning. And when the opportunity presents itself for him to come before King Artaxerxes of the Persian Empire, and Artaxerxes asks him, "What do you need?" Nehemiah is ready with an answer. What we're going to see this morning in Nehemiah chapter 2 is that while we depend on God's power, while we depend on his sovereignty, we also need to carefully organize. We need to put together plans to help accomplish and further his purposes. That prayer and planning, depending on him, work together. We're going to see that we need to pray, we need to plan and prepare while we wait for God. We don't just sit back and say, "Well, hey, when God leads, I'll just jump in and follow." We need to be ready. We need to pray. We need to plan. And we need to prepare. But we do all of that while we wait for God to give clear direction and clear timing as well. So turn with me to Nehemiah chapter 2. What we see in the first 10 verses is that Nehemiah presents his requests to the king. So Nehemiah chapter 2, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence, and the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What are you requesting?" So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone? And when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, and the good hand of my God was upon me. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. If you look at a Jewish calendar, chapter 1 begins in the month of Kislev, which on our calendar would be mid-November to mid-December. Chapter 2 begins in the month of Nisan, which is mid-March to mid-April. So there's a four-month gap between chapter 1 and chapter 2. And so as we said last week, where Nehemiah hears the report about the city of Jerusalem, and he weeps and he mourns for days, and he prays and he fasts. Well, he does that for 4 months, continually praying, God, please intervene. God, please intervene. God, how can I be involved in this? What do you want me to do? And he prays and he prays and he prays and he prays for 4 months. And then it's his opportunity to serve the king. As we saw at the end of chapter 1, Nehemiah is the cupbearer. He's the one who would taste the food, the drink of the king, make sure it's not poisonous. But also in that culture, it meant he was probably the gatekeeper who controlled access to the king. So he would be a close confidant, close companion. So he's on duty. He's bringing wine before the king. He's apparently, you know, after 4 months of being brokenhearted and praying and planning, he comes into the king's presence, and he's a little down in the mouth. And the king, with his keen observation skills, says, what's the problem? Because Nehemiah had never looked that way before. Apparently, he had always been upbeat. He had always been cheerful. But he's got sadness of heart. And when you're sad in your heart, it eventually works its way up to your face. And not only is he sad, but he's now a little bit terrified. Because in that culture, you didn't go into the presence of the king with a sad face. Because the king might interpret it to say, you're upset with me. Off with your head. So there's that danger that not only might he lose his job, he might lose his life. And so Nehemiah he's a little bit concerned. And the king says, hey, what's the problem? And Nehemiah, with probably a little bit of fear and trepidation, says, hey, why shouldn't I be sad when the city of my ancestors is destroyed? Now, when you read verse 3, notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say the city of Jerusalem is destroyed. He says it's the city of my ancestors. It's probably because Jerusalem, that name, is probably politically sensitive. As we saw back in the book of Ezra, chapter 4, when the people had started to rebuild the city, opposition rose up, sent a letter to King Artaxerxes, said, Jerusalem is a rebellious city. And if it gets rebuilt, they're going to stop paying taxes. They're going to stop honoring you. They're going to rebel against you. So Nehemiah is smart enough to not use that word. But what he does is he appeals to the king's sense of honor to say, it's the city of my fathers. It's the city of my ancestors. They're not being honored. Their graves are being destroyed. And so verse 4, the king says, okay, so what do you need? How can I help? And Nehemiah immediately responds with prayer, verse 4. But notice how verse 4 and verse 5 are linked together. It's, I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king. It's not, well, hey, king, let me go away and really pray about this, and I'll come back next week with an answer. It's probably one of the, you know, because he's been praying for 4 months. So it's one of those sky telegrams of, oh, God, here we go. I prayed to God, and I said to the king. So it's probably in the same breath. It's like, oh, God, I've been praying about this. The king's answered. God, give me the words. And I said to the king. And he gives the king 3 requests. First thing is permission to rebuild the city. If it pleases the king, if it's okay with you, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, and again, back in chapter 1, he had been praying not only for an opportunity, but for favor in the eyes of the king. Please send me to Judah. Again, he doesn't say the city. He says, send me to the region. To the city of my father's graves that I may rebuild it. If it's okay with you, King Artaxerxes, and if I found any favor in your sight, send me back to where my ancestors are buried to deal with the rubble, to take care of the city. And the king says, okay, give me a time. How long will it take? And again, this is probably part of Nehemiah's prayer and planning because he gives him a date. Says, well, I think it'll take this amount of time and I'll come back on, this month and this date. But he goes on to say, the second request in verse 7, give me letters of safe conduct. Give me letters to the different provinces I'll pass through that I've got your authority to do what I'm doing. And if I'm not sticking my neck out too far, give me carte blanche, a blank check to do the job. Give me letters to the quartermaster so that he'll provide the lumber, the material, everything that I need to not only rebuild the gate, rebuild the walls, and rebuild the house where I'm going to need to live. And what a coincidence. The king granted me everything I asked. But what Nehemiah recognizes, it's not just that the king is, I got him on a good day. He likes me today. No, it's the good hand of my God was on me. Nehemiah recognizes, you know what? God's answered prayer. I've been praying for 4 months for an opportunity, for favor, and look what God did. The good hand of my God was on me. So we talked about when we were in Ezra, that's a phrase that is repeated 8 times in Ezra and Nehemiah. 6 times in Ezra, 2 in Nehemiah. That Ezra and Nehemiah recognized it's the sovereign God who is moving to accomplish his plan and purpose. He's the one who wants Jerusalem to be rebuilt. It's normally about a 2-month journey from Susa, the winter capital of Persia, back down to Jerusalem. Ezra took 4 to 5 months to do it, but he was taking a lot more people. It says that the king sent an army escort, sent some officers, sent some soldiers to protect Nehemiah along the way. And what a surprise, the Cold Water Committee shows up. Anytime you do something significant for God, anytime you take a step of faith to share your faith with a neighbor, to up how much you give, to take a week of vacation and go on a short-term ministry trip, anytime you do something for God, don't be surprised when somebody steps up and says, "Really? You're going to do that? I thought you were smarter than that. You really believe God can do that? Oh, come on. That was then. That doesn't happen today." And what you see, and we'll see it as this book continues, is the three-part Cold Water Committee. Sanballat, who has a Babylonian name. He is apparently the governor of the region, the governor of Samaria. He would wind up being Nehemiah's boss because of Nehemiah would be under him. You have Tobiah, who apparently is a mixed race because he has a Jewish name, but it says he's an Ammonite. And then in verse 19, we have the third member, which is Geshem, who is Arabian. He is the king of Kedar, which governs part of the region around the Promised Land, but also all the way down to North Africa. And these three men, in this case, it's the first two in verse 10. Like I say, Geshem shows up in verse 19. They're bothered because Nehemiah's going to mess up the status quo. They're bothered that he wants to do something for the people of Jerusalem. See, up to this point, you know, they've got a good thing going. They're keeping the people of Israel under their thumb. They're keeping them impoverished. Heavy tax load, heavy workload, a lot of red tape. You can't do this, you can't do that. And Nehemiah is showing up. Hey, we're going to rebuild the city. And they're bothered, as verse 10 says, that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. Somebody had come to make things better. And that messes up our plans. That messes up our easy life. So verses 11 through 20 describe how Nehemiah develops his plan and then communicates it. It says, "So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I rose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, where I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, and there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and I entered the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, and I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. Then I said to them, 'You see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer suffer derision.' And I told them of the good hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, 'Let us arise and build.' So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite servant, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us, and said, 'What is this thing that you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king?' Then I replied to them, "The God of heaven will make us prosper, and so we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." So Nehemiah arrives. He spends 3 days resting up after a 2-month journey. That would have been natural and normal to take a break, catch your breath. And then he sets out at night with a small group of people, maybe a couple of people with him. He's only got one animal, whether it's a horse or a donkey or a camel. We don't know exactly because he doesn't tell us. But that's all they've got, and they're going to make an inspection of the walls of Jerusalem. And if you look at a map and follow the sequence, he starts out at the Valley Gate, which is on the west side of the city. He goes south down to the Dung Gate. It would be where they took out the garbage. He goes to the east side to the Fountain Gate. And apparently there's a blockage because it says there's no room for the animal to get past. And so he apparently can't go up the rest of the way on the east side. So he backtracks, goes back to the Valley Gate, and he goes back inside. Now, up to this point, Nehemiah has not said, "Here's why I'm here. Here's what I intend to do." He's being a good leader where he's getting firsthand information. He had secondhand information from his brother back in chapter 1 about the condition of the city. But now before he reveals his plans, he wants to know firsthand, what exactly are we dealing with? How long is it going to take? What kind of effort is going to be needed? Max Dupree is a Christian author, leader. He wrote a book, a couple books, one book called Leadership is an Art. He's a former chairman of Herman Miller, which is a furniture company. He said that the first responsibility of a leader is to define reality. The last is to say thank you. In between, the leader's a servant. See, that's what Nehemiah is doing here. Is the first thing he does in leading the people is he defines reality. We have a problem. The walls are torn down. The gates are burned with fire. Now, again, it's kind of a no-brainer because it's been like that forever. It's been like that for 150 years. But the reality is the more you see something, the less you notice it. You can walk by it every day and not even see what it's like. Flowers are there. What color is there? What car somebody's driving? You go through a salad bar and you miss half of it. And it's like, "Oh, where'd you get that?" Well, Nehemiah's pointing out the obvious. We have a problem. This is reality. We're being criticized, we're under derision because we haven't taken care of this issue. And then he starts that aspect of servanthood where he doesn't say, "Hey, we got a problem, get to work. You guys are being lazy, get to work here." No, what he says is, "Join me in the work. Let us rebuild the walls. Let us rebuild it." We say, "Join me. I'll be involved in this. I'm here to help." And again, he's defining reality in verse 18 where he says, "Look what God has already done. Let me tell you how God answered prayer with King Artaxerxes. Let me tell you how the king gave me permission. He gave me safe conduct. He's already provided all the materials we need. All we need is a little bit of sweat equity here now. But look at what God's already done." And the people respond by saying, "Yes, we will. Let us arise and build." We bought in. We're all in. Let's get to it. Let's get started. And again, the Cold Water Committee shows up. And they start out with ridicule. They jeered at us. They despised us. You got to be kidding. You're going to take on an impossible task? You're going to fail before you ever start. So why even bother to get started? You can't afford it. You don't have enough. You don't have enough people. You're doomed. You got to be kidding. That's the dumbest thing I have ever heard. And if that doesn't work, then they start the intimidation. We're going to tell the king. You are rebelling. We wrote about this 2 years ago, and we're going to tell the king as well, because he really doesn't know what you're up to. And Nehemiah responds, hey, we don't need your help, because God's going to do this. One of the things you see in the book of Nehemiah is a model for how to handle criticism. There's times where Nehemiah addresses it directly, and there's times where he just ignores it. This is one of those times where he addresses it directly, where he says, we don't need your help because our God is going to make us prosper. And we, his servants, will arise and build. But you, hey, you have no claim here. We don't need your help. It's the same thing that Zerubbabel said back in the book of Ezra when the people of the land wanted to help rebuild the temple. And Zerubbabel said, hey, thanks, but no thanks. And Nehemiah is following that same policy. The people that are loyal to God, the people that are following Yahweh, they're the ones who are going to do it. And ultimately, God's going to be the one who gets the credit. Because we're going to be involved, but he's the one who's going to make us successful. I take four lessons away from this particular chapter. The first one is that God is in the business of transformation. Changing a heart is his specialty. Nehemiah spent 4 months praying about what to do, and God was at work softening the heart of King Artaxerxes. It's not that Nehemiah had such a great persuasive argument. It's that the good hand of his God was already at work. Maybe you face a difficult boss, a difficult landlord, a difficult neighbor. And maybe you're trying to think, how can I convince them to do what I want, what I need? You know, God is the one who can change their heart. That's his specialty. And our task is to pray that he would be at work, that he would transform, that he would change their heart. And changing a heart is what God does best. He is in the midst, in the business of transformation. A second lesson is that praying, planning, and waiting go hand in hand. Nehemiah spends 4 months praying, planning, and waiting for the right opportunity. It's not mutually exclusive. It's not either or. Either you pray or you plan. It's both. And God can work through both of those. The third lesson is that faith is not a synonym for disorder. It's not a substitute for planning. It's not, hey, I'm just going to walk by faith and we'll just see what happens and let the Spirit lead. Well, sometimes that's just flat out laziness. Because God can lead through the prayer and the planning and the getting ready and the preparation. And so don't use that as just an excuse not to. But because, again, prayer and planning and preparation all go hand in hand. And the fourth lesson is that opposition is to be expected. When we step out to do something for God, there will be people that will oppose us. It happened in the Old Testament. It happened in the New Testament. It happens today. So don't be surprised, but don't give up either. Because sometimes we have the attitude of, man, if things get hard, I must be out of God's will. The reality is you may be right where God wants you to be. And he wants you to persevere and to endure. And just because the critics are there, the opposition's there, doesn't mean he's telling you to stop. It just means there's opposition. Because the cold water committee will always show up. And as sometimes, as author Marshall Shelley says, they come from inside the church. And they are what he refers to as the title of his book, Well-Intentioned Dragons. They've got good intentions, but you're messing with their status quo. And they don't want you to do it. So don't be surprised when opposition comes. But keep praying, keep planning, keep preparing, and trust God to lead and to follow him. Let's pray. Take some time right now to respond to whatever God has spoken to you about today. Ask him to give you the grace and the strength you need to persevere when things get difficult. Ask him to direct your steps to accomplish what he desires in your life. Father, thank you for Nehemiah's example. Father, help us to learn from it, to really understand what it means to depend on you, even as we plan and prepare to seek your face, to seek your direction, and to seek your timing. Father, help us to persevere and to endure, and cause us to be fruitful and effective for you. And we commit all this to you in your name. Amen.